This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane. Time's running out for the federal government to pass several key pieces of legislation before the end of the year. The final fortnight of parliamentary sittings begins today, with an election looming next year. The coalition needs to get bills on religious freedom and a federal anti-corruption commission through soon if it's to keep its election promises from last election. But the fractious issue of vaccine mandates threatens to hold up the Prime Minister's agenda. Here's political reporter Melissa Clark.
Federal Parliament resumes this morning. There's 8 days to get things done before the year's end. On the government's to-do list, a bill to limit religious discrimination and passing new laws compelling voters to show ID at the ballot box. But they're not everyone's top priorities.
People have the right to decide what they want to put into their bodies.
That's Pauline Hanson. The One Nation leader had a private chat with the Prime Minister last week. And the outcome? The government is prioritising Senator Hanson's private members' bill aimed at scrapping state-based vaccine mandates and preventing discrimination against unvaccinated people. Here's Senator Hanson speaking on Sky News.
He's given me no guarantees. Actually, he said they will not be supporting my bill, but will allow his members of parliament to cross the floor to actually support the bill.
Pauline Hanson says she and her colleague Malcolm Roberts will not vote for any government legislation until her bill is passed. She didn't tell the PM that directly when they spoke.
I wasn't. He knows I'm very strong. I didn't say I at that time to tell him.
But she's confident he's heard the message.
I said that in my speech in Yeppoon, which is quite widely spread.
Pauline Hanson's bill will get the backing of some government senators. Liberals Alex Antich and Jared Rennick have indicated they'll support it and also withhold their votes from their own party. Here's Senator Rennick.
This week I intend to withhold my vote from the government until they meet a number of conditions that I've put to the government in regards to the way that people are being treated around vaccines and the discrimination against people who haven't been vaccinated.
National Senator Matt Canavan is backing the One Nation bill too, but not threatening to withhold his vote on other bills.
Well, there is no health justification to force other people to get a jab against their will.
The threat to not vote by even a few senators is a problem for the Prime Minister. Without One Nation, it's hard for the Coalition to get any contentious legislation through Parliament. And with the One Nation bill unlikely to succeed, who knows how long they and other Coalition senators will continue to hold out, which could see the bills on religious discrimination and voter ID not finalised until the new year, when an election could be called any time. As for the government's election promise to introduce a federal integrity commission, there's no sign of that legislation. Labor's shadow treasurer, Jim Chalmers.
Well, the government's not serious about religious freedom or about an anti-corruption commission. If the government was serious about either of those things, it wouldn't have taken them 3 years to get their act together.
That's federal shadow treasurer Jim Chalmers, ending that report by Melissa Clark. There are concerns more people may have been exposed to deadly asbestos after an increase in do-it-yourself home renovations during COVID lockdowns. Many of those projects have been completed on properties that were built during a time when the use of asbestos materials was common, as Annie Guest reports.
When Adelaide resident Matt Werfel was renovating a weatherboard house 20 years ago, he had no idea it contained asbestos.
Drilling and bogging and sanding, unbeknownst to me, the eaves and indeed weatherboard contained asbestos.
4 years ago, at the age of 41, he was diagnosed with the lethal mesothelioma cancer.
My world just fell apart. I knew it was a death sentence pretty much straight away.
The father of three says his prognosis is 1 to 5 years.
I have a young family. It's been devastating for our family.
Asbestos remains in about one-third of Australian homes, despite its biggest supplier, James Hardie, ceasing its manufacture in 1987.
I had no idea. There was no labelling, or I had no idea that it was dangerous products in my house like that.
That doesn't surprise Justine Ross, the chief executive of the Asbestos Safety Eradication Agency. which was set up by the federal government 8 years ago to improve asbestos awareness and oversee its safe management and removal. She says one third of home renovators couldn't identify sources of asbestos in a survey of 1,500 people done just 3 months ago.
People know that it's dangerous, so they know asbestos causes cancer, that's clear, but they don't know that it can be found, you know, in their own home.
And now more people may be at risk after pandemic lockdowns spurred many to undertake home renovation projects.
Almost 50% of those who responded in doing home improvements cited pandemic-related motivations. And concerningly, almost a third of those who responded admitted to illegally disposing of asbestos in their household bin.
About 4,000 Australians die of asbestos-related disease every year, among the highest rates in the world. And to help homeowners figure out if their property has asbestos, the Asbestos Safety Eradication Agency is now developing maps showing regions known to have asbestos in homes.
Annie Guest reporting. Discrimination, low expectations and poor wages. For years, many Australians living with disability have struggled to find work. Now, the Disability Royal Commission is turning its attention to the barriers facing the community when trying to find a job, as advocates say businesses are missing out on quality staff. This story from National Disability Affairs reporter Naz Campanella.
Hello, it's nice to meet you today.
It's a busy day at Sydney architecture firm SJB. The newest recruit on the front desk is Olivia Sidhu, who lives with Down syndrome.
At my job, I do office administration tasks, such as preparing rooms for meetings and meet and greet people who comes in.
The 22-year-old works part-time and gets paid the award wage.
I wasn't nervous, and having a job gives me independence and sense of purpose.
She went through a preparing for work program at Jigsaw, an organisation supporting people with disability find jobs. Michael Summers from Jigsaw has been assisting her with the transition.
Before Liv's first day, I send through a tailored support plan that Liv has put together. This support plan outlines a number of strategies to help maximise Liv's capabilities. For the first couple of days, I'll shadow Liv to make sure she feels comfortable and confident in her role.
While Olivia Sidhu is enjoying her new job, many others with disability don't have work at all. And that's what the Disability Royal Commission will be exploring over the next week. More than 25 witnesses will give evidence about the barriers facing the community. The CEO of the Disability Leadership Institute, Christina Ryan, will be among them and says exploitation remains prevalent.
The expectation that disabled people will work for low wages or no money at all. But there's also an assumption that we should be working at the entry level. This, in some ways, is keeping disabled people at those lower echelons of employment.
And she says prejudice is still a problem.
There's an increasing use of disability recruitment channels. Unfortunately, for many people, that just puts a big target on their back. There's stories that come my way on a regular basis from people saying they've been on interview panels where the team leader or the manager who's recruiting for these positions says, well, we have to interview these people, but we certainly won't be employing them.
Back at the firm where Olivia Sidhu now works, Director Adam Haddow has confidence in his new recruit and says he wanted to hire someone with disability because it was a good business decision.
What Olivia brought to the table that no one else brought to the table was a knowledge about disability, because we design lots of buildings and lots of the buildings we do design have a requirement to deal with disabilities in the way in which we design entries or wayfinding.
And he wants other employers to be more open-minded.
It's a big responsibility to employ somebody. Having a person with disability employed in the office is no different to having anybody else employed in the office.
Businessman Adam Haddow, ending that report from Naz Campanella. Just last week, the Prime Minister said there were hundreds of thousands of jobs that could be filled in the lead up to the summer holiday season. But many young Australians, particularly those outside the major cities, are still finding it hard to get work. The youth unemployment rate is 13.1%. In fast-growing regions like Ipswich in southeast Queensland, community leaders say poor public transport isn't helping, as Stephanie Smale reports.
The city of Ipswich, about an hour west of Brisbane, is home to one of Australia's biggest Pacific Islander communities. But church leaders like Pastor Sue Nakisa-Oti are concerned that many young people aren't working.
Too many young kids, they don't do anything and they end up doing some silly stuff. They end up with the liquor system and they can't wipe that off. And that really stopped them from enter any sort of workforce.
Australia's Pacific Islander population has almost doubled in 10 years and is expected to keep rising. But Pastor Sue isn't convinced governments are doing enough to help young people with multicultural backgrounds to find jobs.
I wish the government really engaged to the community because as far as I'm concerned, we are the one that's seeking help. They not step out and say, hey, listen, this is what we provide for you. I don't see that happen.
The CEO of the Ipswich Community Youth Service, Amanda Majerison, agrees it's particularly hard to find a job in fast-growing communities outside major cities.
If you're looking at areas like Brisbane that has existing rail, it has new light rail being implemented, you've got the Olympics coming up in 11 years, and then you come out to Ipswich where a lot of young people, young families are being pushed due to the affordability of living, and even Ipswich is becoming unaffordable. The flow-on effect is that the infrastructure isn't there to support young people and young families to access the services, businesses, etc.
Plans for a new rail line linking Ipswich and its surrounding communities to Brisbane have been stalled for more than a decade, with state and local governments blaming a lack of federal funding for the delay. Amanda Majerison again.
However, my understanding is that's years away and reliant on funding to bring that along, if at all. That would, of course, create additional opportunities for young people's movement.
She says her organisation works closely with federal and state agencies, which are trying to reach young people out of work. The last federal budget set aside more than $480 million to help 15 to 24-year-olds find work or do further study. But Amanda Majerison points out even those who have a job aren't getting enough hours.
We have a lot of casualisation of industries like hospitality, where young people may be picking up a number of shifts but would definitely have capacity to pick up additional.
She says affordable accommodation and access to financial support while training are also major barriers. That's why she's keen to continue working with state and federal governments to develop new ways to help young people get a job and keep it.
Stephanie Smale reporting there. Australia is being urged to help Pacific Island countries struggling with low COVID vaccination rates by ramping up efforts to fight vaccine misinformation. New modelling from the Lowy Institute think tanks again exposed the sharp vaccination divide in the region. While Fiji and several smaller Pacific Island nations have vaccinated the vast majority of their populations, several Melanesian countries are lagging badly and are years away from vaccinating enough people to curb the impact of the virus. Here's Foreign Affairs reporter Stephen Jedgetts.
It's a worrying sight in a country where almost nobody has been jabbed. Protesters in Papua New Guinea railing against COVID-19 vaccines. But it doesn't surprise Port Moresby Governor Powers Parkop, who says online misinformation has fuelled widespread resistance to vaccination.
Certain sectors of our community having strong opinion against the vaccine, and they have been supported, sadly, by even doctors, people who should know better.
And now data highlights just how badly Papua New Guinea is lagging. Less than 4% of PNG's adult population has been fully vaccinated. And the Lowy Institute estimates at that rate, only 16% will be vaccinated by the end of next year. The Institute projects only a third of PNG's adult population will be fully vaccinated by April 2026, almost 5 years from now. The Institute's Alexandra Deant says the main problem isn't really a shortfall in vaccines, but rampant distrust of government and NGOs, a shortage of health workers, and weaknesses in the health system.
I mean, you can't send 10 million vaccines to PNG now, first because of the vaccine hesitation, vacancy in the number of healthcare workers, but also you have like a limitation of the refrigerators in which you can put those vaccines.
It's not just Papua New Guinea. The Lowy Institute projects that Vanuatu will only have vaccinated 56% of the eligible population by December next year, while Solomon Islands is projected to reach 66% of people in the same period. Alexandra Dayant says the challenges are similar but less severe than in Papua New Guinea, and Australia should consider boosting programs to fight vaccine misinformation in the region.
In Melanesia, vaccine hesitancy really spans from the poor to the elite and the rural to the urban. Like, really, it's everywhere.
Burnet Institute CEO Professor Brendan Crabb agrees. He's joined a campaign pressing Australia to spend $50 million on combating vaccine hesitancy in both the Pacific and Southeast Asia.
We haven't anticipated the barriers that are there to getting those vaccines that are being supplied into arms, and we need a rethink.
Still, if things look grim in Melanesia, the picture is much brighter elsewhere in the Pacific. In Fiji, more than 90% of adults have been vaccinated, almost entirely with vaccines donated by Australia. A host of smaller nations in Micronesia and Polynesia have effectively reached full vaccination, or are close. And Lowy gives some credit to the Australian government, which has committed 11 million vaccines to the region, vastly more than any other donor. But back in Port Moresby, Powell's Parkop sees a much more grim and uncertain future for Papua New Guinea.
The way we're going with the low vaccination, we will be in this quagmire or forever.
Port Moresby Governor Powell Parkop ending that story from Stephen Jedgetts and our Papua New Guinea correspondent Natalie Whiting. In the US state of Wisconsin, protesters are planning to trace the route Kyle Rittenhouse took last year when he shot and killed two people and injured a third during a march against police brutality. He was charged over the deaths but acquitted over the weekend, and that sparked another wave of demonstrations across the United States over inequities in the justice system. Here's North America correspondent Catherine Diss.
Back to Beaverton, you bag of shit!
Emotions are running high on American streets. The country is again questioning the inequities of the criminal justice system.
Kyle Rittenhouse is guilty, no matter what they say.
By the law, the video evidence shown in court demonstrated Kyle Rittenhouse acted in self-defence, shooting only once chased upon. But what the verdict doesn't do is satisfy demands that those involved in vigilante behaviour be held to account.
Every wannabe white supremacist vigilante, every little Nazi who can go all of us, fierce, courageous, have their names dragged through the mud in that court.
As Kenosha went up in flames amid racial justice protests in August last year, following the police shooting of black man Jacob Blake, Kyle Rittenhouse travelled from his home state of Illinois to join a group of armed citizens claiming to protect private property.
Our job is to protect this business, and part of my...
He hit the streets armed with a borrowed AR-style semi-automatic weapon. Many argue he was a dangerous vigilante who set out to cause trouble and then used the danger posed to his life as a defence in court for shooting people on the street. Criminal lawyer Shana Lloyd spoke to ABC America.
Had Rittenhouse been African-American young man, would the sentence or would the verdict have been the same? Statistically, what we find is that it would not be. And so that is the injustice that people are looking at this verdict in. It's not necessarily just about Rittenhouse. It's about the larger picture of the criminal justice system and how it disproportionately affects black and brown individuals when they are on the other side of that.
But like most things in America, there's two sides to this story.
Justice was done in that, Brett, and the jury system works. You know, I was a prosecutor for 7 years, and those charges should never have been brought.
Republican Chris Christie spoke to Fox News Sunday.
Those people on the left are just attempting to continue to tear our country apart for political gain. Anybody who looked at the videos of this could tell that this was an act of self-defense. And I hope that everyone will leave this young man alone now. He should not become a political symbol for anybody.
The case has reignited fierce debate over the boundaries of self-defense and questions why the law continues to favor those holding the gun. This is Catherine Diss in Washington, reporting for AM.
That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Ange Lavoie-Pierre from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal. The Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, has been talking up the future of the coal industry in the decades to come, despite others' predictions that market forces will soon render coal irrelevant. So, who's right? Today on The Signal, the future of mining in Australia. How much more coal are we really going to dig up and sell, and what other kinds of mining might take its place? Look for The Signal on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.